Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Christopher Hayes, whose book is titled Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy. Christopher Hayes is host of Up with Chris Hayes on MSNBC, frequent guest with Rachel Maddow, editor-at-large with The Nation. Christopher Hayes, this book concerns a thesis about the nature of meritocracy in America, equal opportunity and equal outcome. Let me start by asking you, where did the origins of the thesis come from? I know you said you went to Hunter High School, took a test to get in, which put you in the elite at that point. But there's more to it than that. How did you actually arrive at this thesis, and when did you decide to write the book?
I've been working for a while as a journalist and thought I wanted to write a book. And the book actually started not from the argument that I ended up making about meritocracy, but it actually started from the place in which I was experiencing what I call in the book the crisis of authority in American life. This discrediting of all our pillar institutions, the historically low levels of public trust we have in them. And looking at that in light of this as a reaction to and an effect of the tremendous amount of elite and institutional failure we have over the course of the decade. So that the starting point of the book was that fact. Thinking about the way that I think orders our structures our public life, and then trying to get to the bottom of it.
Okay.
And as I tried to work through in my reporting and my thinking and research, I kept coming back to the process by which elites are formed. And the process of elite formation and selection largely is this thing that we call the meritocracy.
You obviously read C. Wright Mills and other people when you were, I guess, in college. And at what point did you come back to going, hey, I've got to look at this history. I'm going to look at C. Wright Mills again. I'm going to look at the evolution of the elite in America.
Fairly early on, I started to dive into the literature of elite theorists. And Mills is approaching the problem from the left, but he's drawing on a number of writers, three primarily, Vilfredo Pareto, Gaetano Mosca, Ortega y Gasset, who are all writing about elites and the power that elites have, and particularly writing about elites under conditions in which, you know, growing democracy across the continent in Europe. And this question about where power in the society that is democratic will ultimately reside, will it be in the hands of what Ortega y Gasset contemptuously calls mass man, the industrial brute who makes up the urban working class, or will it be in the hands of some elite? And that literature is been kind of abandoned in many ways. I mean, there's C. Wright Mills, and then Christopher Lash after Mills writes in this vein as well. But after that, the line kind of ends, even though it's an incredibly important, fruitful line of inquiry, given the way that society looks right now.
Well, we started in Europe. We have this aristocracy that's, you know, generational. It's an inherited aristocracy. It comes to America, and you've got the landowners and the merchants in the North and the South. But they, of course, were not going to let normal people vote directly for senators or for presidents. So even then, despite their talk of democracy, you know, they were not democratic in that, you know, fully democratic.
Yeah. I mean, I write in the book at some length about these kind of dual inheritances we have as Americans. We have a democratic inheritance, an egalitarian impulse. The idea of a nation founded without the legacy of feudalism and nobility, obviously founded on the backs of slaves, which is sort of exempted out from that vision. So we have this, you know, all men are created equal, egalitarian impulse that de Tocqueville very rightly recognized as leading naturally to universal suffrage and expanding the franchise. And then at the same time, we have these deeply elitist impulses and institutions and structures. The United States Constitution creates four different institutions, the House, the Senate, the presidency, and the Supreme Court, and only one of which is directly elected. So there's incredible skepticism of mass man, to use the phrase before it's coined. And, you know, Jefferson and Adams write back and forth about the natural aristocracy of men and the best government being one that selects out those with the natural aristocracy. the founders were really deeply elitist in certain ways, but we've the cycle of the country has been these two impulses have sometimes waxed and waned, and often the country goes through periods of democratic or egalitarian movements that force elites to give up power, and then retrenchment, consolidation, rinse and repeat.
Well, you've got in history some very bizarre aspects of how popularism takes over. Like Andrew Jackson was the first great populist president, yet at the same time he was also a mass murderer in terms of the Indians. So you can't look at black and white at any point through our history.
Yeah, and populism obviously has a very complicated history for a whole bunch of reasons.
But then we've got something now. We come to meritocracy, and you discuss it a lot in your book, Christopher Hayes, and how now we have an elite that seems to have come up, or at least ostensibly comes up through the ranks of all of the people. We've got more women, we've got gay people, we've got black people who are running the country, frequently into the ground, but they're running the country, and they came up the hard way. They didn't inherit necessarily.
Right.
They didn't inherit their success. But it still comes back to this notion of, and as I was reading the book, I kept thinking, you never use the words, but I kept thinking social Darwinism.
Yeah, there's something that, in terms of the model of ceaseless competition, that is what the meritocracy is, both in the way that we conceive of it. I mean, when we talk about American meritocracy, we're talking about the American dream in its current incarnation, we can't help but invoke sports metaphors, you know, the level playing field being the most common one, or people all starting at the same starting line. And we think about races and competitions, et cetera. And this model of competition, I mean, competition is really important in a lot of different areas. It's part of the key of functioning market economies. But, you know, competition is not the sole model for human interaction, even if it is increasingly, it feels like, the sole model for the production of elites, right? The idea that the way that we order society is that everyone competes on a level playing field, people from all backgrounds and races, creeds, colors, and geographical origin, for these scarce set of slots at the top, the small amount of good-paying jobs and fulfilling lives. And that creates all kinds of pathologies, I think, in the people that manage to ascend through that.
You know, I keep thinking people I know who went to Harvard or Yale or Princeton all wound up at the top. People I know from Binghamton University, we were just as smart, I think, when I've met them.
Yeah.
They didn't. I mean, you got a couple of lawyers and judges, but nobody rose to the top. And, you know, the entire idea that the cream rises is not necessarily true even there. I mean, it goes through this cycle anyway.
Yeah, I mean, what you see are, A, that we don't live up to our own meritocratic promises. So the meritocracy, you know, is one thing in theory and another in reality. And in reality, it doesn't do a very good job of even being very meritocratic. It doesn't produce a lot of social mobility. In fact, we have, in the period of time that we've adopted this model, we have declining social mobility over time, increasing inequality. And it doesn't necessarily do a great job of selecting out, you know, who indeed is the best and brightest, the most talented and hardworking. And partly that's because of the difficulty with the concept when you zoom in on it. I mean, from a distance, it's hard to disagree with, oh, well, people with the most merit should have the most important positions, right? I mean, we don't want to give out surgeon's licenses by lottery. So there's a certain intuitive appeal to it. But when you zoom in on the concept, what does merit mean? It actually gets a lot more complicated. Is it smartness? Is it how quickly you can think? Is it a certain kind of confidence or charisma? Is it how hardworking you are? And then if it is how hardworking are you, how do you even begin to measure those things? There's a lot of attributes that are bound up in there that when you scratch them, they get a lot more complicated.
Well, including ambition and the ability to jump over other people if necessary, which seems to be both a way to get ahead, and yet at the same time it creates miserable human beings.
Right, and it comes back to this model of competition and the way that that relates to compensation, particularly in places like Wall Street, which really views itself in very explicitly meritocratic terms. This is something that came across in my interviews, but also there's a great ethnography of Wall Street by a woman named Karen Ho that I'd recommend called Liquidated. And, you know, Wall Street really does view itself as being the cream having risen to the top. It views the money it makes as deserved because of that. It views the distribution of income that it is part of producing as a necessary feature of an efficient society that rightly rewards the people who are the smartest. It's a very self-justifying story, and what ends up happening is that because merit is so elusive and so complex, what you get instead is that money stands in as a badge of merit.
Which brings in another area that you actually don't discuss in the book, which is the relationship of historical Calvinism to this, where, insofar as I know, maybe you know something different, rich people tended to be treated as if they're somehow good people. In other words, God is rewarding you, and the role that the ethics of the morality of wealth would play in the society.
Calvinism, the Calvinist idea of the elect or the saved, and the elect or saved being God's mystery that is then revealed through worldly success, is a cousin, I think, of the modern meritocracy we have. Although one of the things I think that system tended to value virtue very highly. in a way that I'm not quite sure. I mean, it explicitly didn't mean that it wasn't honored in the breach, but
right.
I'm not sure our current system. I mean, when you read the emails of people on Wall Street, the one that I quote in there, that's a testimony before a Senate Permanent Subcommittee Investigations about someone who was working at Moody's, working with an investment banker on a rating a proposed security, and he's asking for too much due diligence, and the investment banker on the other side of the deal says, you know what, just do the deal and get it done, and if it goes wrong, IBG, YBG. I'll be gone, you'll be gone. And that's essentially the moral articulation of an ethos of looting. and that I think, is in some ways a much more common set of moral norms, particularly on Wall Street.
You're listening to an interview with Christopher Hayes, whose book is Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy. I'm Richard Walensky. You say in your book, and there's a quote, meritocracy represents a rare point of consensus in our polarized politics. What that means is that when you're talking about the IT guy in San Diego, who's obviously not at the top of the heap, you know, he's looking at that world, and he's not necessarily seeing those emails. And from his perspective, perhaps, or her perspective, those people are good because they're wealthy. They deserve their money, even if he doesn't have it.
Yeah, I think that's both true and a little more complicated, because I think one of the really fascinating things about America right now is that, A, there is a broad sense across different ideological parts of this, points in the spectrum, of betrayal, that the game is rigged. And I think that's actually a very common feeling, and it's part of what this lack of trust in the institutions is part of. But I also think that, you know, we have this almost kind of neurotic feeling about mobility in this country in the classic Freudian sense, which is things that we have repressed. There's like repressed knowledge. So if you ask Americans about the ability of starting at the bottom, working your way to the top, compared to almost every other country in the world, they are more confident of one's ability in the U.S. to do that. And at the same time, the reality of social mobility is that it's worse than almost any other industrialized democracy in the world. So there's this huge tension between our aspirations and our reality, and that tension manifests itself in the kinds of frustration or sense of betrayal that I talk about.
There's also the element, the Norman Vincent Peale element. We think positively, suddenly we're going to get ahead, and that goes on despite the brick walls. I mean, so we're talking about contradictory belief systems all occurring at once here.
Yeah, that's right. And it produces a lot of frustration.
Right.
The frustration, I think, is one of the defining moods of the country, at this point in time.
Okay, so now we've got this elite, right, that's becoming more and more limited because we're talking about these schools becoming more and more the elite schools, so that people like yourself, even from a place like Brown, aren't necessarily going to get ahead. You have to be from Harvard, right? And forget about Binghamton or even Berkeley, right? Okay, so it's getting smaller and smaller. People need more and more money to get decent education. So on some level, we're actually slowly reverting away from a meritocracy and back toward an aristocracy.
Yeah, that's exactly what's happening, is that it's moving towards something that looks more aristocratic, more oligarchic, in that the scarcity of the educational resources particularly jacks up the price, and then there's a bidding war for them. And this is true about bidding wars for all kinds of what we call in economics positional goods. So, you know, houses in good school districts. So even if you're not paying, you're not bidding up the cost of the education in a straightforward manner, but you're bidding up the cost of a house in, say, Scarsdale, where there's a good that's a suburb of New York with a, you know, very good school system, or Marin County or somewhere like that.
Right.
Yes. And so what's happening is intergenerational mobility is declining, right? Which is to say your parents' income and education level is becoming a better predictor over time of what your income and education level will be. And that's, again, the opposite of what the foundational promise of the system is. So you have to ask this hard question of, if the system isn't delivering on its foundational promise, maybe there's a problem with the system.
Well, then let's talk a little about the system, Christopher Hayes. Let's talk about the relationship of the Republican and Democratic parties in this. I mean, you know, the Democrats are supposedly the party of, quote, the people, but then we've got people like Dianne Feinstein, who clearly is, you know, putting forth bills for her class.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two ways to look at this. One is that there are tremendous similarities between the two parties in terms of the strata that, you know, the meritocratic success stories that are the folks that are not just the elected leaders like Barack Obama, but also the staff members and the advisors. So there's that. There's also the fact that there's this gift economy. There's this way in which public power can be traded or cashed out for private wealth. In, say, Peter Orszag leaves being Office of Management and Budget, goes to work at Citi, making about $1 million a year. That's based largely on his contacts, et cetera.
Right. That's pretty standard. I mean, that's been going on a long time.
Sure, but the lucrativeness of the payouts gets bigger and bigger over time. And then the reverse of that is that private money can purchase public power. So we know this from the way that studies of Senate voting records and who they listen to, which are their constituents, right? That only the folks in the top third of the distribution are really swaying their votes in any ways. So there's a kind of seamless back and forth movement and circulation of elites between the positions of public power and private power. And that is true across both parties. Now, there are huge distinctions in the two parties just based on what their coalitions are and what the interests of those coalitions are. And those make a big difference in how they behave themselves. The Democratic Party took huge political risks to cover a lot of people in health insurance for no reason other than the fact that there's a certain ideological commitment to that. But also, those are the folks that happen to be in their political coalition. and when you have a political coalition, you know, you have a political coalition that is on one side represents increasingly the multi-ethnic future of the country, and the other that increasingly represents old white folks. You know, those produce very different priorities as well.
Well, you've still got, you know, from the Democratic side, you've still got, you know, Goldman Sachs running Treasury, and you've still got a health care plan, which, yes, Paul Krugman says, okay, we'll improve it down the line, but it's a health care plan that benefits the insurance companies. So, you know, even from that perspective, maybe it's the best Obama could have gotten. That's a whole different discussion.
Yeah, sure.
But even from that perspective, we're talking about the old Roman idea of the patricians and the plebeian, and even the plebeian party was patrician.
Right. I mean, one party has at least its interests split a bit, and one party doesn't. I mean,
right.
It's
easier for Republicans not to have to, you know, lie in that sense.
Right. Although the Republicans, I mean, we should be clear about the Republicans as well. I mean, let's remember, this is the party that, you know, says they're committed to smaller government. You know, government grew during the Bush administration with the Republican Congress. This is a party that says that they're opposed to the public sector encroaching on or providing health care, right, in any way, even through this kind of Rube Goldberg machine of the Affordable Care Act, whose candidates ran against incumbents in 2010, attacking the incumbents they're running against for voting for a $500 billion cut to Medicare. That was the tagline. It's the tagline that Mitt Romney will use again in attacking the Affordable Care Act. So, you know, we tend to think of politics in incredibly ideological terms, even when the coalition of interests belies that sort of ideological purity.
You're listening to an interview with Christopher Hayes, whose book is Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy. I'm Richard Walensky. Let's move slightly afield here, because there are many other issues that involve this, one of which is the relationship of the elites and how the elites think among themselves. People I've talked to, from Anna Quinlan on down, now you live in Brooklyn, so you're slightly off the beaten path, but everyone I've talked to who spends any time in Washington, this goes back to my interviews years ago with Molly Ivins, would talk about the village there, they didn't use that word, and received wisdom in the Beltway, and that how that echo chamber has no relationship to the rest of the country.
I mean, the term that I use to describe that phenomenon more broadly is social distance. And social distance is something that is just the distance in the lived world, in just the day-to-day world, lived world of decision makers and the people who those decisions affect. And a certain amount of social distance has always been the case. I mean, for instance, being a politician is a weird thing. It's a strange, idiosyncratic, bizarre way to comport oneself and to live one's life. And that necessarily alienates you in some pretty deep ways from the lived reality of a lot of other people. You always have staff around you, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a certain amount of it that is unavoidable, but the more intense, I mean, here's a perfect example of something that's happened in the last 3 years that's probably exacerbated that. Metro Washington has one of the healthiest economies in the entire country. It has one of the healthiest economies in the entire country because of the economy of influence that sprung up around lobbyists, because of so much money of our national security state, and just generally the amount of money that the government spends has gone out, and a lot of it increasingly is contracted out. So there's all sorts of private firms that are being paid by the taxpayer but are technically in the private sector, which is – and so I think that has profound effects on how seriously Washington takes joblessness, for instance. It's a subliminal effect, you know. The staffers who live in Washington are living in a city that has new sushi restaurants opening up and a certain amount of vibrancy to it and economic dynamism. And, you know, that's a long way from Youngstown, Ohio. So that, you know, even though there are people in Washington who are representing Youngstown, Ohio, the lived world reality of the elites, particularly in Washington, is so removed from that.
Well, and that of course, played a role in the build-up to the Iraq War. I mean, you know, I remember talking to Gail Collins and saying, well, why didn't the New York Times understand what we out in California saw immediately, which is Iraq isn't going to work? And all she could say is mea culpa. It was as if they lived in, you know, in this fantasy world that nobody got any other information from. And that's part of this as well.
Yeah, I mean, social distance produces a certain amount of isolation. Isolation necessarily means you have access to less information. You know, I think that the Federal Reserve, you know, when you compare the Federal Reserve's response to the growth of subprime lending to the response of nonprofit groups that were working in communities being devastated by subprime lending, you know, the groups that were dealing with folks every day who were being ripped off and who saw what was happening to lending standards and these bizarre new kinds of stated income loans and, you know, loans where you could choose a payment every month, which is just, you know, the opposite of the purpose of a mortgage. You know, they started sounding the alarm bells, issuing reports, predicting huge numbers of foreclosures and crisis and blah, blah, blah. And they weren't listened to at the Federal Reserve, even though they were meeting with the folks at the Federal Reserve. And I think largely because the Federal Reserve were just remote from that sector of the market. They could read the charts. They could listen to them in these meetings. But they were remote in a lived sense from the realities of that market.
Well, when you start talking about words like derivatives, you completely forget about the fact that there are actually
human
people behind
there.
Yeah.
Them, yeah.
Yeah. You talk about why people think certain ways, principles of knowledge. You talk about consensus ideas. We all believe certain things. The proximity to power, you know. I'm here in the radio station. Any conflicts here, I'm going to know about more than the listeners, for
right,
example.
Exactly.
Right. And, of course, the assumption is that everybody's operating in good faith.
Yep.
But all of these three things, these three elements, when you're dealing with an elite that's socially distant, you know, the consensus, they're making up the consensus.
Right. Yeah, all these things have broken down because of the experience of the decade. I mean, if you look at the consensus, the false consensus that was formed around Iraq and weapons of mass destruction, the false consensus that was formed around, or elite consensus about the housing bubble and the subprime market, you know, that's discredited consensus. If you look at, you know, proximity is another rule of thumb I use, right? You know, Judy Miller had amazing access. I mean, she was, you know, watching interrogations and talking to the people in the know in the White House, and it proved to be a completely unreliable means of getting to the truth. And then good faith, just the assumption that people aren't being intentionally and systematically fraudulent and deceitful. And that also, particularly with weapons of mass destruction, particularly in what was happening on Wall Street, where people were being intentionally fraudulent and deceitful. I mean, so all three of those kind of rules of thumb we use to form our knowledge about the world have been discredited, and we're left adrift and disoriented as to how we go about constructing a useful set of rules for acquiring knowledge about public life that we need to be citizens.
Okay, so now we're at this point, okay? You know, when you're talking ideology, you tend to talk, okay, communism, socialism, capitalism. Does that play any role, the relationship of economic systems, in your theories about the nature of elites? Or is that human psychology, and no matter what system you're dealing with, you're going to wind up with an elite dealing in the same way?
Different systems, I think, produce different kinds of elites, and each set of elites have their own dysfunctions and pathologies. And the system that we have produces a specific set of them. You know, I think that, you know, clearly Bolshevism, for instance, produced a set of elites that had very profound dysfunctions and pathologies and ruthlessness, etc. So I think kind of elite pathology is probably a common thread throughout all society. But how that manifests, what the particulars are, and how destructive it is or isn't, I think is very dependent on the model that produces elites, and then how accountable they are, how close they are, what are the mechanisms of this basic kind of democratic accountability, these counterbalancing forces. And I think those have diminished over time in the U.S.
And the other question I have concerns something that you kind of hit on at the back of the book, which is where we go with this. America is trying for that level playing field. Okay, we're trying for this equal opportunity for all. Okay, we're not achieving that, and that's falling by the wayside. But you talk about something called equal outcomes. I'd like you to go into a little bit about what you mean by that, and if our goal is a return to equal outcomes, which we had more in the 50s, mm-hmm. when we had a less meritocratic society in that sense, how do we get back to that?
Well, first I'd say I don't think for myself, I don't think equal outcomes is achievable or even necessarily a worthwhile goal in and of itself. I mean, even during the period of the great wage compression, obviously there were people that were wealthy and people that were poor. It's the right. question of what the distance is between them.
Right.
So it's a reduction of the vast inequality of outcomes we have now, as opposed to just brute, you know, equality of outcomes. Look, making a more equal society from a policy perspective is not rocket science. I mean, if you waved a magic wand and tomorrow there was a 50% top marginal rate that applied to all income across, you know, wages, capital gains, investment, carried interest, et cetera, and, I don't know, $12 minimum wage, $10 minimum wage, you know, you'd reduce income inequality quite a bit. if you had a program where you staked everyone to a certain amount of assets, a bank account with savings that could be then drawn on for education or buying a house or things like that. If you had Medicare for all and genuine single-payer health care, and if you massively expanded the budgets of state secondary education systems, which are getting cut and cut and cut, and tuitions are going up and up and up, and that difference is being made up with student debt. I mean, look, there's a lot of ways to do this. So it's not a policy problem. It's a political problem. It's a power problem.
And how do we get back to answering that question about the power problem, then?
Yeah, I think the power problem is, you know, it's a complicated one. I have some weird hope that there's this sort of potential for the upper middle class to have their frustration and anger and betrayal channeled into a more kind of egalitarian agenda. And you see this actually in some interesting polling. I think the failed decade has been felt most keenly by the upper middle class is a disruption. I think poor folks have had institutional failure as a mainstay in their lives for a long time. The working class, the folks in steel towns that were deindustrialized, have seen institutional failure for a long time. It's people with professional degrees, relative degree of affluence, a certain amount of confidence that the social contract is functioning, going to work for them, who I think look at the crisis and its aftermath, particularly the financial crisis and its aftermath, as a betrayal. And I think there's opportunity for that group of folks to be organized and to demand, you know, even something, I mean, even though it sounds like the lamest, most tried liberal thing to say, oh, you know, raise top marginal tax rates, that would really be a good first step. I mean, it would be good to show that we still have the capability to make that happen.
But, you know, it's kind of hard to do that when you're looking at the polls and you see Obama, you know, even given the fact that a lot of people are completely disgusted with Goldman Sachs' relationship to the Obama administration, mm-hmm. and the way Obama has not rolled back mm-hmm. a lot of the worst elements of the Bush administration. And then you've got Romney, which we don't have to go right. into at all, and they're tied in the polls. How are you going to move ahead when you're about to take four steps back or hopefully merely toe the line?
You know, the polarization that the country has is increasingly fascinating to me, and I think important to understand. I mean, if you become the nominee of a major party, you've got about a 45% floor, no matter who you are.
Right.
I mean, just
right.
if you get sent out by, you know, that's just the nature of the way that our party politics work. And so I think a lot of it in some ways has to happen. I mean, I think a lot about what it would take to make the Republican Party more responsive, because in some ways, I think about this on climate. Like, that is the bigger problem. You can't just have one party that you can effectively pressure to get anything done. I mean, Martin Luther King Jr. understood that.
Well, actually, if you look at New York State and gay marriage.
Perfect example. So the question of, like, how – I hate this kind of trope of, oh, the Republicans used to be sensible and now they're crazy or blah, blah, blah. I don't think that's actually got a lot of good explanatory heft to it. That said, there has been a radicalization in the Republican Party, and that radicalization is – gravely threatening, because it means that they've loosed themselves from kinds of accountability for certain things that we need them to be accountable for if we're going to push a progressive agenda.
You're listening to an interview with Christopher Hayes, whose book is Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy. I'm Richard Walensky. Christopher Hayes, a couple of questions about you. Now, somewhere along the line in your 20s, you went from being a professor to being a media star. How did that happen?
I was an adjunct teacher at a community college in Chicago. I was mostly, you know, my wife and I moved to Chicago in 2001. She grew up there. Her family's from there. And I just started, freelancing. I started writing a lot for the Chicago Reader. It's a local alternative there. And I got an incredible journalism education there. And in fact, I was like the last generation of young writers that were able to come up through alternative weeklies because those are now essentially destroyed and defunct. And so, yeah, I was really lucky to get this kind of amazing journalism education there. And Chicago is a relatively inexpensive city, particularly housing costs there. So what it meant was, you know, my wife and I lived on very little money, and she worked in social services for victims of domestic violence. And I just freelanced, and then I waited tables or I picked up odd jobs writing reports for nonprofits, and was able to spend a lot of time reporting and writing, and just, you know, in a way that would have been hard in New York, where I had been struggling to pay the rent. And ended up with a job at a place called In These Times magazine. It's a small lefty magazine in Chicago. They got a grant, and they hired me for a year. And from there, I went to The Nation. I was writing for The Nation for a year. And then my wife got a clerkship in the Supreme Court. We moved to D.C. in 2007. And I just got extremely lucky again in that David Corn, who'd been the Washington bureau chief of the magazine for 20 years, left a month after I got to Washington to go run the bureau at Mother Jones. So there was this opening. I got hired to be the Washington bureau chief. And from there, I started appearing as a guest on MSNBC.
Was that with Rachel Maddow, or was that with Olbermann?
Actually, it's funny. The first time I ever appeared on MSNBC was on Countdown, but it was the first time Rachel was guest hosting Countdown. But I would then appear a lot on Countdown and then on Rachel's program as well. It happened, actually, because we had a really great PR person at the magazine, at The Nation, who was in contact with some of the booking producers at Countdown and pitching me, and eventually they put me on, and I didn't do a terrible job, and so they had me back. And, you know, at one point in, I guess it must have been 2010, around February, Rachel was taking a trip, I think, to Afghanistan, if I'm not mistaken, and they needed someone to fill in while she was en route, and asked me to come down to New York, and I filled in, and the show went pretty well, and I became a regular fill-in for her. And then last year in the spring, I had a meeting with the president of the network, Phil Griffin, and talking about what my role was going to be at the network, and I said, what do you guys think about a weekend morning show? He's like, huh, interesting. And then from there we developed the weekend morning show, and now I host it.
And at that point, I mean, the first time you got paid was when you sat in for Rachel then, right?
Yeah, I didn't have a contract with the network until after I sat in for Rachel signed a contract then.
At that point. Just curious, I don't know if you can give that away, but what do you pay what do they pay for being a sit-in for Rachel? I'm not going to ask for what your fees are.
Well, there's no standard. I mean, different people have very different contracts at the network, so mostly it's contributors who have contracts that are structured in all kinds of different ways.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to get a sense of, like what kind of money do they pay? You know, those of us here at KPFA.
I will say that, you know, TV, cable news is lucrative. I don't have any other skill set nor can envision any other endeavor that would compensate me at the same level that my current endeavor does. You know, and the other thing about TV is that it's very volatile.
Right.
It's incredibly volatile.
You don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, I feel kind of lucky. I love doing the show, and I feel lucky for every weekend that I get to do it. And it's not something you could bank on long term. Every weekend we get to do it is kind of a gift.
Well, then let me ask you. Okay, now you're on television, right? And over this time, how does the celebrity culture involve you, or does it? Are you still under the radar?
You know, I get recognized more often. Being out on book tour, we've been selling out the events, and I think the reason the events sell out is because I have a television show, and if
right,
I didn't,
yeah.
They wouldn't. I have no
Got
illusions
it, yeah.
about that. You know, I don't think it doesn't feel burdensome
right.
or that distortive, although maybe I'm just ignorant to how distorting it is. But, you know, look, I also, in the same period of time, my wife gave birth to our first child, our daughter. And so, you know, most of the time I spend that I'm not at work, I'm with
Your
my
home.
Family
yeah.
And thinking about how to be a good dad and a good husband. And, you know, I don't know, take the subway, bike to work. it's, you know, this is not to say that at the same time, yeah, I'm very lucky. I mean, I have a lot of privilege right now. I'm very aware of it. But I don't feel whatever kind of recognition people have, it always feels pretty low key. People, I like your show or right. I don't or whatever. But then you just kind of go about your life.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a big difference between you or even someone like Roger Ebert and big stars. And Roger was always,
right.
you know, knowing him was always the same no matter whether he was on TV or not. So you never felt – I never felt hanging out with him that I felt I was hanging out talking about movies.
Right,
so
right.
That kind of
yeah,
thing.
And I think that's a level – like there's – you know, obviously there's different kinds of levels of fame in different ways in the grand
right.
scheme of things. I'm lucky not to be that famous.
well, you know, but you are in a political context, which means you're getting crap from the right wing and mm-hmm. probably some from the left mm-hmm. as well. How do you deal emotionally with that? How are you able to function with you know, I hate to use the term, but I'm going to mouth breathers breathing mm-hmm. down your neck?
That's a really good question. So the internet is a double-edged sword because at the one level it opens you up to feedback that is really important and good and sometimes critical but bracing and smart and penetrating and makes you better and points out things you did worse. And then it opens you up to a lot of toxic invective and trolling and contempt. You know, the challenge is you don't want to be obsessively open to everything that everyone says about you on the internet, because you'll go crazy and you'll feel horrible all the time. At the same time, you also don't want to close yourself off from it, because you want feedback. And you want feedback that, again, smart criticism. I can't tell you that I have the answer for how to navigate that. It has been an emotionally fraught process, to be entirely honest about it. You know, I think we're conditioned as people to care what people think about us. And when the number of people that have strong opinions about you starts to multiply, you go through a period where you have to kind of figure out how to cope with that psychologically and emotionally. And I'm not sure I've kind of figured it out yet.
So, I mean, do you just kind of like, oh, I can't. I mean, I there's some conflict here at KPFA, and I was online the past few days and got invective that I've never gotten before. And I'm freaking out over it. I just want to say, okay, screw this. Screw politics. You know, I'm just going to interview, like, mystery writers.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. The first time that you get it, it's like a knife to the heart. I mean, it can be really – then you kind of grow these kind of – your skin toughens up. You grow these calluses over your soul, as we joke about on my staff. And, you know, look, if I take a step back, it's like I said before, I'm so privileged and lucky and fortunate to have what I have. And part of the price you pay for that, part of the cost of this thing that I love doing, that I'm well compensated to do, that I really enjoy, is that you get a lot of heat sometimes, and you're in the public eye, and there's feedback, and that's part of the bargain. You don't get the good stuff without the other stuff. That's how it works. So you just figure out a way to kind of accept it and deal with it in as sane a way as possible.
Christopher Hayes, a couple of other quick questions. One of which is something I would ask pundits. You know, people who talk to a lot of people who are pundits. Right-wing pundits tend to say things which are so completely whacked that you just sit there and go, do they really believe what they're saying? So I'm going to ask you, because it's the same question I've asked Maureen Dowd, Gail Collins, and others. Do you think they believe what they're saying?
I think it depends on who it is. I never really feel like I'm in a great position to judge how genuine folks are. I think there are incentives, particularly on the right, towards outrage and shock that I think bend people's behavior, whether they're aware of it or not. I think it's pretty rare. It's pretty rare, I think, that people are self-consciously duplicitous or self-consciously putting on an act. I think there are some exceptions, but for the most part, I think people end up convincing themselves of what they spend all day articulating. I think that, you know, that goes for everything from lawyers to radio hosts.
Do you get any pressure from MSNBC, or they just let you do what you want?
We have remarkable attitude. I mean,
really?
Yeah. I mean, we did 2 hours on Israel-Palestine. We did 2 hours on atheism. We've done 2 hours on the Iraq War. We've talked about the prison industrial complex, drug legalization, you name it. I mean, I literally have never gotten editorial direction from my bosses.
At all?
Ever.
And on your show, how much of a role – you're a producer. How much of a role do you play in the decision-making of what you're going to do? Is it 100% or?
Well, I wouldn't say 100% because that sounds like I just come up with everything, because I don't. It's an extremely collaborative process. We have an amazing, amazingly talented, smart, curious, thoughtful, hardworking staff. My executive producer is really visionary and brilliant. Ultimately, I'm the one who's got to drive the ship on the show, and ultimately, things aren't going to work as television if I'm not really into something. So ultimately, I have the kind of final say, because the format of the show is so improvisational. It's very little scripted. It's kind of conducting a conversation. It's just not going to work as television for me to go out there and half-heartedly try to make a conversation happen that I don't have purchase in. I don't feel the stakes of. I don't have skin in the game.
Right.
So it ultimately ends up being, you know, the final say about whether we're going to do something or not comes down to me, because I'm the one that's going to sit out there and talk about it.
How do you think being on television now, for how long have you been on now doing the show?
About 10 months.
About 10 months.
9 months.
You feel comfortable doing it now?
Oh, I feel extremely comfortable. I felt pretty comfortable doing it from the beginning because we created a format. You know, we were very lucky. We got to build the show from scratch, more or less. We didn't inherit a format. We were able to construct a format that played to my strengths and minimized my considerable weaknesses as a broadcaster. And, you know, from the first day we did it, I felt very comfortable. I love doing it. I feel I'm so locked in for that period of time on the show. And I feel like I learn from the show. I like meeting the people that I talk to. I like the fact it's social. I'm a social person. I like meeting a lot of different people and hearing different ideas. And I really like it.
And you know, I guess you have to have that little voice in your mind saying, okay, this is still me. I'm just a person, and I'm just doing these conversations, that I'm not somehow bigger, you know, I'm keeping my head under control.
One thing that I have realized quite quickly in over the last year or two between, you know, the show and the book is that whatever little dopamine squirt in your brain that happens from recognition or accolades, you know, the returns to that diminish quite quickly. If you're doing it for that, you're going to be miserable pretty quickly. You got to actually love the thing that you're doing and be passionate about the thing you're doing and feel rewarded by the thing you're doing. Digging into the, you know, details of LIBOR, finding someone to talk about the economy who hasn't been on TV before but has a really important perspective. That's got to be the thing that drives you and you find fulfilling. Otherwise, you're going to be, you know, famous and well-compensated and miserable. And that is not an unheard-of combination.
Christopher Hayes, wake up. You need to find information quickly. What sites do you go to?
Twitter is kind of the backbone for me right now, my Twitter feed. So much information comes in through there. And I follow a ton of people, and it's curated in different ways. You know, I read the New York Times. I don't have an original answer to that. It's, you know, pull up the Times homepage. That's usually the first place I go.
Well, actually, you do, because you follow all these Twitter feeds. Is there any particular person or feed that would?
Oh, there's too many to start
really?
To start on.
How many do you look at every day?
Well, I follow about 500 people, but that's not that. I mean, there's more I should, and I should do more curating with lists. But that's
at this point, do you think Twitter is the place to get information? Then, I mean, it seems to be such an unregulated, huge area to just go.
Well,
okay, you know.
The thing about Twitter is that it's a really useful way of curating what you look at, because there's human judgment involved. So if a bunch of people are tweeting a link to a story, you should probably check out the story out, and that's a kind of useful, just kind of parameter to use when you're trying to figure out what to read with a limited amount of time.
Yeah, well, what I have a lot of very knowledgeable friends on Facebook, and I'm on the well. Christopher Hayes, now you've written Twilight of the Elites. You've got your show. What are you working on now beside your show?
I am going to work on spending a lot of time with my infant daughter when I'm on a book tour, to be totally honest. There's a few essays I probably want to write in the fall. For the Nation, that I've been thinking about some long-form stuff, thinking about what the next book project will be, but I'm going to wait on that a little bit.
And who's going to win the presidency?
You know, I think it's basically a 53% chance of a Barack Obama win, a 47% chance of Mitt Romney win, something like that. You know, better than a coin toss, but not by much.
You've been listening to an interview with Christopher Hayes, whose book is titled Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.